Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now.
Welcome to the National Writers Series. I'm Doug Stanton. Over his long career in public service, Richard Clark has been an advisor to Presidents Reagan, Clinton, and both Bushes. His 2004 memoir, Against All Enemies, was critical of multiple administrations for their lax approach toward counterterrorism before and after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and of the Bush administration's decision to wage war in Iraq. Richard has also written four fictional thrillers. His latest book is called Warnings: Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes. He talks this hour with fellow retired political advisor and co-chair of Traverse City's International Affairs Forum, Jack Siegel. Jack asked Richard to explain who Cassandra refers to in the title of his book.
Cassandra is a story out of the classics. She lived in Troy, and she was cursed. Well, she was blessed and cursed by the gods. The blessing was that she could accurately see the future. Now, that's great if you're a day trader on the stock market, but the curse was no one would ever believe her predictions. And so she saw that Troy would fall and the city would be destroyed. And she went around telling everybody. She told the king, she told the prince, she told everyone in the city, and they thought she was mad. And they ignored her. And that drove her mad. But the thing to remember about Cassandra is that she was right. And why we chose that metaphor, my co-author and I, is that we were trying to see if there was a phenomenon where there's a disaster, there's an investigation. The investigation always turns up somebody, some guy or some gal, who before the disaster said it was going to happen. Well, you know, there are people running around, chicken littles, who say things like that all the time, but the kind of people we're looking for in this search for Cassandra are people who, like Cassandra, were right, and they were experts. So the search was, could we find a pattern here that whenever there's a disaster, if you go back and look, there was an expert in the field who had data. They didn't just wake up on the wrong side of the bed one day. They had data, they predicted it, and they were ignored. And we found that over and over and over again in every field. We found it, and we'll talk about some of these, but we found it in international security. We found it in economics. We found it in engineering. We found it in every scientific field. And so we did case studies of these people who we call Cassandras because they were right and they were ignored. And then we thought, well, if we're right about this theory, there must be some out there now. So we looked around and tried to find people who fit the bill, who were experts, who were predicting disaster, but the disaster hadn't occurred yet. And so we did case studies of them. So there are seven case studies of people who were right, ignored, and there was a disaster. And there are seven case studies of people who are now predicting disasters. And we ask, is there a way to find out, are these people going to be right too? And in the book, we came up with a little formula. It's very simple, but it's 24 factors. And we apply these 24 factors to all of the 14 case studies. And time again, in each case, all of those factors lit up.
You're going to find this when you read this book that it's really annoying and you know the stories that are being referred to, the wars, the conflicts, the terrible tsunamis that, and we'll get into some of those in just a minute. But Dick, most people know that you had a Cassandra moment of your own. If you go to Google and you Google images and you put in Richard Clark Al-Qaeda, you can read a memo that Richard Clark sent to Condoleezza Rice about Al-Qaeda. And now this was an unknown organization at the time, except in Dick's very talented office and a few people around government. You sent this memo, and was this a Cassandra moment? What is it that stopped the administration saying, oh my gosh, we really have to listen to this guy? He's an expert. He knows what he's done his research. He has the evidence. Why didn't they act?
Well, the book Warnings is not about me. But I will admit, one of the reasons I was interested in this phenomenon is that I did kind of feel like I had been a Cassandra briefly. And when we did the study and we tried to find out why people were ignored, there were a whole series of factors. And I did go back and I applied them to my own case. And yeah, they were the same factors. When you look at the list in the book of the factors of why people are ignored, the one that is the most powerful is what we gave it a fancy name, first occurrence syndrome. It's a good social science kind of name. It really means this has never happened before, or this is happening for the first time. And so when I said, we're going to have a major terrorist attack in the United States, and hundreds of bodies are going to be lying in the streets. Yeah, Condoleezza Rice didn't believe me. None of the Bush senior leadership believed me. Fundamentally because they couldn't get their head around it because it never happened before. We hadn't had 3,000 people killed in an attack in the United States since Pearl Harbor Day. There hadn't been, since Pearl Harbor Day to 9/11, there had never been a major attack on that scale. 3,000 on Pearl Harbor, 3,000 plus on 9/11. Hillary Clinton, in her book, What Happened, quotes my book, which is nice, and she said, you know, we knew during the election campaign that the Russians were messing around. And the Obama administration knew it in some detail. But no one thought it was a big deal. No one really did enough to draw attention to it. And we can get into a debate about whether the Obama administration did enough, but she obviously thinks they didn't. And she says this was a case of first occurrence syndrome because nobody could get their head around, including her, could get their head around the notion that the Russian government could somehow affect our election. It happens over and over and over again that things occur for the first time and we see them coming at us, but we either don't recognize them, our pattern recognition system doesn't work because we've never seen it before, or we just don't believe it, or we don't believe the magnitude of it.
Now, you, in the beginning of the book, then, you do give some case studies that are really quite stunning and, as I said, annoying. We had a visitor here, Robert Ford.
Great guy.
Ambassador Robert Ford was here, and he mm-hmm. talked to the International Affairs Forum. And he is one of your examples mm-hmm. in talking about Syria. And maybe you could retrace some of that history and explain how it applies in this context.
So the case study with Ambassador Robert Ford is about the rise of ISIS, the terrorist group. Now, remember that ISIS, until relatively recently, contained an area on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border. They ran cities, big cities. A terrorist group running Mosul, a city of 2 million people, running Raqqa in Syria, a city of 750,000 people. They ran a big piece of territory, bigger than many countries. They had oil production. They were a terrorist group running a country. They had seized their own country. Bob Ford saw this coming. Who is he? He was a Foreign Service officer, an expert in the Arab world. He had served for decades in the Arab world. And he was kind of, you know, the Lawrence of Arabia type, that he would sneak out of the embassy and go to the souks, go to the markets. And he had great Arabic. And, you know, there are like six dialects of Arabic. He has them all. And he would just wander around the streets and go to coffee shops and talk to people and get the feel for the streets. So he really understood the Arab world. He is then appointed our ambassador to Syria. And he sees what's going on in Syria at the time, the beginnings of the uprising against President Assad. And he had just come from being the deputy ambassador in Baghdad, so he knew what was going on there. And he put the two situations together, and he said, wow, what's going to happen here is there'll be a little revolt against Assad, and the terrorists will take it over. And they will unite with the terrorists in Iraq, and they'll create a terrorist state on both sides of the border. And he went to the Secretary of State, who was Hillary Clinton at the time, and she said, wow, you're right. The Secretary of Defense also saw it and said, wow, you're right. But when they took it to President Obama and the folks in the White House, they said, are you kidding? A terrorist group that we've never heard of, that doesn't exist yet, is going to pop out of the desert, out of nowhere, and it's going to take over cities in two countries? You know, stop smoking that stuff out there in the souk.
It's legal now.
Yeah. So he said, no, this is going to happen, and the only way around it is for us to support a counterweight and get involved in the Syrian uprising. And Obama said no, and exactly what Robert Ford predicted happened. And the result of our not acting is that we had to fight ISIS, we had to send in troops, send in aircraft. And if you look now at those cities that ISIS took over, they're all ruined. I mean, these big cities in Iraq and Syria and in Libya look like Berlin in 1945. They look like the scenes out in California from the fires. The cities are leveled. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people have been made refugees. It was a terrible five-year struggle to suppress them. And I think if we had paid attention to Robert Ford, our Cassandra, we could have nipped all of that in the bud.
Now, this suggests there's a kind of an institutional bias and also a personal tendency maybe on the part of top-level leaders. That's not in my program. That really interferes with all the things I want to accomplish. I want that to go away. I want you to put that back and study it some more.
Exactly. We also have a social science-y name for that, which is agenda inertia.
Agenda inertia.
Agenda inertia. Okay. I got my agenda, and I'm going to keep going. But when you think about it, a president of the United States, a president of a university, a CEO of a company, they've been selected, not because of their hair color, but because they said, if you choose me, I will do this, and here's my program. And so now they become the president of the university or whatever it is, and they want to do that program. And now you come into the room and you say, excuse me, I know you're doing your program over here, but I know something you don't know about something that you've never thought about, and it's more important than anything you're doing. So drop all of that stuff and work on my issue. And by the way, I need all of your resources. From the decision maker's perspective, you do understand why sometimes they really do exactly what you said, which is say, go study that some more. Or in the case of the engineer in Louisiana, who, this is before Katrina, looked at the dams and dikes around New Orleans and said, if we ever get hit by a Category 4 or a Category 5 hurricane, those things are going to blow and the whole city is going to get flooded. He was a professor of civil engineering at Louisiana State. They fired him. They fired him from the faculty.
And that's not there's a similar example with a very fascinating backstory to it about Fukushima, and a warning that was delivered 1,000 years before they built the nuclear plant.
Yeah, 400. So I don't know if you remember the horrific scene. I thought I was watching a science fiction movie. There were four nuclear power plants on the coast in Japan, outside a town called Fukushima. And you could watch on TV, one by one, as they blew up and released nuclear material. We had a terrible incident during the Carter administration with Three Mile Island, a nuclear reactor in Pennsylvania, melting down, blowing up. This was four of them happening simultaneously, and the wind drifting toward Tokyo. Incredible disaster. It's cost an enormous amount of money, billions of dollars to clean up. You still can't go back and live in that town. Well, it turns out when they were asking for the permit to build the four plants, they had to do an environmental hearing to get the permit, to get the building permit. And an engineer shows up at the hearing and says, you can't put the plants here because someday there'll be a very big wave. And unless you have a giant seawall, all your plants are going to get flooded. And they said, what are you talking about? That's never happened. And he said, well, actually, it did. He said, it happened 400 years ago. And they're like, well, how the hell do you know that? And he said, well, I went to the site, and then I climbed up the hill behind where you're going to put these plants, and there's a big rock halfway up the hill, and it says in ancient Japanese script, don't build your house below this line.
Not a very subtle message. I mean, no. It's pretty clear.
Don't build your nuclear power plant below this line. Because, in fact, 400 years earlier, there had been a major earthquake. It had produced a major tsunami. And the water had gone up the hill. They ignored him. He went to five hearings. He wrote up all the technical specifications, totally ignored. And you know the rest. There was an earthquake. There was a giant tsunami. It flooded all four of the nuclear power plants, which meant that their cooling systems didn't work anymore. And they all melted down and blew up. He nailed it.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Richard Clark talks about why he's concerned about artificial intelligence.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Jack Siegel's conversation with Richard Clark, whose latest book is called Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes.
There are lots of fascinating and rather scary stories in this fabulous book. One that really got my attention and got me thinking had to do with gene editing. Now, this is a hot subject in industry and agriculture and in medicine. And it sort of led, in the way you described it, to what I would describe as unnatural selection, a non-Darwinian approach. And there's a wonderful quote from E.O. Wilson in their book, and I will read it. The real problem of humanity, we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. Now, there's a lot going on in this field, and you have described some of the Cassandra moments, and there are more than one that is happening right now. What could you maybe explain how this stuff works, and how is it a danger? Should we be worrying about it?
Well, so this is one of the future possible Cassandras. So the seven case studies of the future, one of them is gene editing, and I don't make a judgment in the book about whether this is a bad thing or not. I just lay out the facts through the mouth of our Cassandra. Cassandra, in this case, is the woman who invented the gene editing technique, Professor Dudna from the University of California at Berkeley. She's a wonderful person, and she worked hard to come up with a way of dealing with the worst birth defects by taking that part of the DNA that is the defect and snipping it, cutting it, and removing that piece of the DNA and inserting normal good DNA. And she probably deserves a Nobel Prize for this. She wasn't the only one working on it, but she was one of the leaders in the field. And this technique is called CRISPR. Don't ask me to say what CRISPR stands for, but because it's a long... I wasn't good in chemistry. That's why I ended up in the State Department. But so you would think, why would this wonderful woman, scientist, be a Cassandra? Well, she told me, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about Dr. Frankenstein. Because if you remember in the movie, in the Mary Shelley novel, Frankenstein is the inventor. The monster is not Frankenstein. It's Dr. Frankenstein's monster. And so she wonders, you know, am I Dr. Frankenstein? Have I invented a monster? Because that same technique that could be used to cure any number of awful genetic defects could be used to enhance genes, could be used to give to newborns or people in the babies in utero or IVF, superhuman capabilities. Now, ethically, the medical field won't do that right now, even though they maybe could right now. But who is to say that China, which is doing a lot of work on CRISPR-Cas9, more than we are, or North Korea, or who knows who. Imagine North Korea producing an army of supermen through genetic modification. Babies who were born and grew up, who were all, you know, 6'5", and obeyed orders. You know, the perfect North Korean army. So she worries, have we let something out of the bag here that can be misused? I don't know whether she's right. And in all of the seven chapters at the end, you've got to decide whether the person is or is not a Cassandra.
And that, I mean, that terrifying prospect that you just laid out of not a benign country, a country that has is our adversary at least, to say, well, we're going to experiment with this, and so it's being passed around in the medical community world, yep. And other worlds, I guess.
Yep.
But I could see, people may start with something like, I want my child to have higher intelligence, or to be stronger, or to have blonde hair. And then it goes from there.
It could. It could create a caste society. You could imagine some totalitarian government like China or North Korea deciding, well, we're going to have a small elite, and they're going to have extremely high IQ, and then we're going to have some workers. And it becomes, you know, an ant colony after a while.
Is there anything be done about CRISPR, about it, this problem at the political level? Is there any way to ensure we have good CRISPR and not bad CRISPR?
Well, so in each case of our future Cassandras, they all have something they want us to do. It's not just they're running around with their hair on fire saying that this terrible thing is going to happen. They all believe that the terrible thing they're predicting can be stopped. And in the case of CRISPR, Cas9, what Professor Dudna would like is for us to take the ethical code that the U.S. medical community and the European medical community have adopted, that we'll fix birth defects, but we won't create enhancements. We won't create super people. And put that into law at the national level and through an international convention. If you had an international convention and people like China signed up for it, as you know, you'd have arms controls kind of verification, You'd have people going around inspecting labs to make sure that wasn't happening. Now, maybe they could still do it and hide it away somewhere, but it would be harder.
Now, another area of technology and development that seems to have a similar problem is artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And you use a lot of examples in your fiction, which is these are terrific reads. They will keep you up at night because you just want to keep reading them. I recently read a discussion about driverless cars, mm-hmm. and where the algorithms that are being developed have to decide, okay, the car is coming along the road and suddenly a baby carriage comes out in front of the car. But the only option for the car is to drive into a telephone pole. Now, so they have to decide which way will the car go. And I could even envision companies saying, our car will protect you, not the baby carriage. These decisions are going to get made through algorithms. And again, it's a question of, is there anything that can be done to sort of steer this, if you will?
So artificial intelligence is here. It's being used every day. If you go to some place in the world when you have never been before and you use your credit card, within seconds, an artificial intelligence program back in New York somewhere probably runs a program, an algorithm, to decide whether or not it's you that's in Buenos Aires tonight. Artificial intelligence is today working in lots of areas. And we don't see it. We don't know it's there all the time. But it's exploding and being used in every imaginable field. The reason we put it in the book is we found Cassandras who are afraid that it will take off and we won't know what it's doing. And when I looked at that, I thought, well, that's a crazy idea. You know, I saw that movie, you know. And by the way, a lot of the problems with the Cassandras is that they're predicting something that actually was in the science fiction movie. And we'll talk about that when we get to asteroid impact. But it turns out, if you've seen something in the science fiction movie, and then somebody comes into you and says, this is really happening, you don't believe them, or you don't take them seriously. Well, artificial intelligence is doing things today that we don't understand. For example, it's making decisions about approving mortgages at banks. And until recently, it wasn't clear why certain people were getting approved and certain people were getting rejected. And so there was some research to decide, you know, is there a pattern here? And it turned out the artificial intelligence was racist. And it was rejecting African Americans at a very high percentage, having nothing to do with their credit worthiness. How the artificial intelligence came to that conclusion, we don't know. Because the problem with artificial intelligence and machine learning is that it learns on its own, and you don't know what it's learned. And it gives you a result, and you can't go back and audit that result. You can't figure out how it got there. So when I read that, I thought, well, maybe this is an issue. Maybe this is a problem. Then I read, and this is really when it convinced me, that Google had created artificial intelligence programs, and two of their artificial intelligence programs began talking to each other, and machine learning, you know, it's creating its own algorithms. These two algorithms figured out these two devices could talk to each other better if they invented a different coding language. So they invented a coding language and began talking to each other, and Google didn't know what they were saying to each other. This is true. So you had two machines talking to each other in a language that they had invented that no one understood. Now, why don't worry too much about this right now? Is what Google did is what, you know, it's kind of obvious. They unplugged them.
But if you read Breakpoint, one of his terrific books, and you discover something called living software doing exactly what he just described, which is not fiction, And then one day the two computers, or the 2 million computers, talk to each other and say, you know, the weak link in all this is the people. So let's get rid of them and let's get them out of the loop. And there was a cartoon recently in the New Yorker with the robot saying goodbye to the last employee,
yep.
Saying you'll have lots of time now to watch Netflix.
So that's the other fear that our Cassandra has had in the book about artificial intelligence and machine learning, which is it's taking away jobs. Now, I know we've all heard that. I think, you know, when I was in high school, I heard the automation. We didn't call it robotics then. We called it automation. Automation was going to take over and we wouldn't have any jobs. So we've heard this before. And there are a lot of economists that say, no, it's just changing jobs. Now, instead of doing, you know, the work on the assembly line, you get to repair the robot that does the work on the assembly line. But combined with this business of them making decisions that we don't understand is the fear that if we don't control the expansion of machine learning, that artificial intelligence, when combined with robotics, and there's huge progress in robotics in the last 5 years, go to a website called Boston Robotics and watch the videos of these robots. They're incredible. Combining robotics with machine learning, artificial intelligence, might really threaten a lot of jobs and might eliminate a lot more jobs than it creates. So that's the twin fear with that, Cassandra.
Now, our theme in the International Affairs Forum has been envisioning the future, and one area that you've been writing a lot about is the advances in warfare,
mm-hmm.
particularly if we focus on one, drones. The use of, they don't like them to call it unmanned aerial vehicles because they actually use a lot of people to run them. So they're
remotely piloted vehicles.
Piloted vehicles.
They have a pilot, but she's sitting in an office somewhere in Las Vegas.
Yeah. So it began under President Obama that drone strikes began to be the weapon of choice.
Well, we began them under President Bush.
We began them under President Bush. And President Obama, the slope went up sharply.
Huge increase.
At that point. Yep. Now, it strikes me from reading what you've written about this that there's no limitation on terrorist groups going to one of these shops that sells robots or sells drones and buying off the shelf something pretty sophisticated and then putting a bomb on it.
Yep.
Are we going to be seeing one of these things flying into the Super Bowl game one day?
So Jack's referring to, I think, my novel. So there's a novel I wrote called Sting of the Drone. And in Sting of the Drone, some terrorists in Afghanistan want to get revenge because some of their family have been killed by drones, U.S. drones. So they go after the U.S. drone program, and they go after the pilots. The pilots actually are in Las Vegas, in the real world and in the book. They sit in Las Vegas and drive drones over Afghanistan and kill people. And one of the things, I don't want to give too much away about the novel, but one of the things that happens in the novel is that the terrorists come to the United States and buy and use drones against us. I won't give too much away. So I wrote that and got the usual, you know, sort of titters of laughter out of people in Washington. And then it started happening. We've seen ISIS did it, use drones, commercial drones, the ones you can buy on the internet, and put explosives on them. The president of Venezuela was almost killed a couple of months ago with a drone with an explosive on it. And when you say, could it be used at the Super Bowl, one of the dirty little secrets of the Secret Service, the people who protect the president, is they are really afraid of drones because you can buy them for $1,000 and you can launch them from anywhere. You can put an explosive on it. And if the president's giving a speech somewhere outdoors, yeah, you could fly that drone. And maybe they'd see it at the last minute and shoot it down. There's a lot of work going on in trying to figure out what we could do to detect it and to knock it down. But one of the reasons you don't see the president giving speeches outdoors too much is that.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Jack Siegel's conversation with Richard Clark. Support for this broadcast provided in part by Becky Thatcher Designs, where you find jewelry to commemorate the landmarks in your life, at their stores in Leland, Harbor Springs, Glen Arbor, and Traverse City, and on the web at BeckyThatcherDesigns.com.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Jack Siegel's conversation with political advisor Richard Clark.
I wanted to make a quick tour of the world, if I may, in this envisioning the future context. The military likes to talk about the most dangerous threat. They categorize threats in the most dangerous. Our president has had one summit with Kim Jong-un, and he seemed happy. They both seemed happy. But now what's happening
next? They fell
next,
in love.
They got along.
Well, he said, I love him.
The talk stalled, apparently, and there are reports that Pyongyang has built numerous small missile launch sites in the mountains, and really nothing has changed. I guess the bottom line question is North Korea capable of striking the U.S. now? Are we already at risk from an attack from Kim Jong-un?
North Korea has an inventory of nuclear weapons. We can argue about what the number is, whether it's 40 or 80. Experts differ, but they have a lot of nuclear weapons. They have dozens of nuclear weapons. Could they put one of them on a steamer, on a freighter, and drive it into Los Angeles Harbor and light it off? Yeah, sure, they could.
Oh, well, that's a relief.
Could they put it on a missile and fly it to the United States? We're not sure that they could do that today. Again, you could get a debate among the experts. They've tested long-range missiles that could hit the United States. They haven't gone through all of the tests that we would go through, so they probably don't have that capability yet. But the missiles they do have can obviously hit South Korea, can hit Japan, and can hit our bases in the Pacific and places like Guam. Yeah, we've never really had this problem before. We've had nuclear weapons around since 1945, but we've never had a small country that's run by a small clique. It's like a family-owned business where one man is really in charge, and we don't understand him very well. And there are reasons to believe that it's a little weird, but, you know, presidents are sometimes. But we've got a renegade regime, an unstable regime, that has said in the past they want to go to war with us, and they have nuclear weapons. And it's not clear that we can deter them the way we deterred the Soviet Union and now Russia. It's a new problem. It's one of the reasons why we have to be very careful Iran never gets a nuclear weapon, because they might use it.
They do not yet have an operational nuclear weapon. They haven't tested one anyway.
The judgment of the U.S. intelligence community is that they do not have a nuclear weapon.
Iran.
Under the agreement that Obama worked out, John Kerry worked out, they took 90% of their nuclear material and exported it after they signed the agreement. The agreement required them to give up 90% of their weapons-grade nuclear material, and they did. They shipped it out of the country, and that was all audited and verified and monitored.
Now, we are not applying pressure to North Korea right now, it seems. We are applying extreme economic pressure on Iran. Mm-hmm. Karen and I, when you were Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs, we were in the European Bureau slaving over verification agreements with the yep. Soviets. And that took years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was bad. None of that work seems to be going on. So, you know, if we reached a new agreement with Iran, it would have to be more than a nice paper that the two leaders would sign, I assume.
So the Iran agreement that Obama got has verification, and it has close to go anywhere, anytime to do inspections. And that work is going on, even though the U.S. is no longer party to the agreement. The other nations, France, Germany, England, the United Nations, they're all doing the inspections of Iran, and so that work is continuing. And there's good reason to believe that the Iranians are living up to the agreement. With North Korea, we have not begun to talk about verification. And frankly, I can't imagine that North Korea would ever allow us to go everywhere we needed to go to find out whether they'd hid any nuclear bombs away. North Koreans are very good at a number of things, and one of them is building tunnels. And the entire country is just filled with tunnels and caves. And you'd have to go around inspecting all of them to see if they had nuclear weapons. In my novel, Pinnacle Event, I talk about a real world that's fiction, but I begin with a real world fact that you know, that is South Africa had nuclear weapons. South Africa built 6 nuclear bombs. Under the white apartheid regime. And then they said they had a change of heart. They wanted to come back into the world community. They were going to get rid of apartheid, and they were going to get rid of their nuclear bombs. And so they said they destroyed them. Well, no one ever saw them do that. So that's all true, and then the novel takes off from there.
Yeah, it'll definitely keep you reading, wondering where is this going to end up, and with the ending, I wouldn't tell you a word about it, but it's a mind-expanding experience.
It's a trick. It's a trick ending. It's a trick ending.
Another big area that we look at in the future, climate of the planet seems to be changing. The fires you mentioned in California. We had a visitor here, Rear Admiral Tidley, a couple of years ago, and he said he was at that time in charge of Norfolk, and he said, "I don't care what you think is causing it. It doesn't matter. The sea level is rising, and we are spending billions of dollars to raise all the port facilities in Norfolk yeah. to accommodate our ships."
Yeah.
This is happening, and yet the Cassandras that are screaming now quite loudly about it are being ignored.
So we have a Cassandra in the book named James Hansen, who is a professor at Columbia and a former NASA scientist. And he is the first one, if you go back to the 1980s, to say that there's climate change happening and it's going to cause rapid sea level rise. Why he's in the book is that he was obviously right about that in the 80s. Now he's saying all of the calculations that the governments of the world are using on sea level rise, the rate of sea level rise, are wrong. That the UN model is wrong. He says they are predicting sort of a linear increase. And if you look at the NOAA, the U.S. Government estimate, I think it's 84 inches rise by 2150 or something like that. What Hansen says is it's not going to be linear because it accelerates. And the way in which the ice melts in Greenland and in the poles, it melts through the ice. And that creates a lake under the ice. And that lake becomes a skid plane. And then the ice skids off that skid plane and into the ocean. And he says you're going to get very rapid sea level rise. When we interviewed him, it seemed credible. Unfortunately, the UN has already changed its worst-case prediction, and it's getting closer to his prediction. He's still an outlier, but gradually, as more data comes in, this is one of the things we talk about in the book, you know, don't just believe or not believe the Cassandras. Monitor the data to see, are they becoming right? And in the case of sea level rise, they are. I went down to Norfolk, and I happened to be there on a day where it was high tide and a full moon. Hmm. And they closed the schools in Norfolk. And I said, I don't understand. Why are the schools closed today? All right, it's raining. But they said, no, if you get rain, heavy rain, high tide, and the full moon, we get floods. We call them king tides, and they happen every couple of months, and they flood the city. It's also happening in Miami. It's happening in a number of cities around the world. And the problem is, well, there are a number of problems, but one of them is if we lose large parts of Florida, if we lose lower Manhattan, if we lose large parts of Boston and San Francisco and the other coastal cities, that's going to have a devastating effect on the economy. And we're going to have to move millions of people. I don't know where we're going to get the money for that. But there's absolutely no planning going on for that sort of thing. Now, some of the cities are. New York appointed a climate change czar. Boston has actually got a sea level commissioner. But, you know, that's at the city level doing planning. It ought to be at the national level. And there's no planning going on at the national level to deal with sea level rise.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about the solutions that that you talk about at the end of the book, the Cassandra coefficient.
Yep.
And the National Warnings Office.
So we went through all of these cognitive biases that prevent people from realizing that the Cassandras are correct. And we came up with this test that you can do when somebody walks into your office with their hair on fire and says the sky is falling. And it's a test not only of that person, it's a test of the issue, of the problem. It's a test of the decider, of the decision maker. And it's a test of the critics of the Cassandra. So you have to look at the formula has to apply to all of these four areas. And if you get a high result, a high coefficient, what we call a Cassandra coefficient, then you probably should pay attention. Now, that doesn't mean you should drop what you're doing and, you know, run out and work on their issue. But it does mean you need to pay attention. And so what we suggest in the book is we ought to have I'm not big on creating new bureaucracy, but we ought to have a small group of people. I used to say in the White House, but no, not in the White House. A small group of people at the national level who kind of scan the horizon for these Cassandras and bring them in, hear them out, test them in some way, maybe using our Cassandra coefficient formula, and then decide, maybe we should hedge our bets. Maybe we should start planning just in case they're right. Maybe we should do some programs to be ready when we see it's coming that we'll be able to increase those programs. We don't have anything like that. There used to be in the intelligence community, you remember, a National Warning Officer. Isn't that a great title? We had someone called the National Warning Officer, and there was a small staff, and they looked around for what the intelligence community and the rest of the government was missing. That office was abolished about 15 years ago. So we don't have anybody to deal with these issues that are falling between the cracks. We don't have anybody to deal with these issues where the people in charge probably aren't doing enough. In the book, we talk about asteroid impact. And I know that sounds like a crazy idea, but wait till you read the chapter. It's not a crazy idea. And
it has happened.
It's happened a lot. And we don't really have Bruce Willis ready to... Every time I talk to an audience about this, they say, well, yeah, but, you know, I saw the movie and Bruce Willis gets in the space shuttle and blows up the asteroid. We don't have that. What we do now have, because of the work of our Cassandra in the book, David Morrison, is that NASA has now established, Congress made them do it, an Office of Planetary Defense. And they are beginning to systematically scan to look for these asteroids, and they're beginning to develop a plan so that maybe someday in the future, if we saw an asteroid coming, we could do something about it. The last time we saw one was about 4 years ago. We had 48 hours notice, and thankfully it hit in the desert in Sudan. But it was large enough that if it had hit in a city, it would have wiped out the city. And this does happen. Now, most of the world is made up of water, so they hit the water. But city killer asteroids are a thing that historically has happened a lot. And so having the ability to see them coming, that helps. And now the Office of Planetary Defense is doing that. But I would be a lot more comfortable if when we saw them coming, we could do something about it.
National Warning Officer. Imagine what the kids of that guy had felt, you know, when you got a warning from your dad and he's the National Warning Officer.
Or better yet, he's the Planetary Defense Officer.
Yeah. All right, let's bring the lights up and give the audience a chance to participate. And we have microphones that will be available, and if you'll put your hand up, we'll be happy to ask you, stand up if you can, and give us your name and fire a question.
My name is Dan, and
real close to your mouth.
There we go.
Some of the top scientists in the world have all signed a document stating that we should not pursue artificial intelligence. Maybe you can expand on this document.
Yeah, so in the book we talk about some of the people who you may have heard of who think artificial intelligence and machine learning could be a problem. People like Bill Gates, Elon Musk. I know Elon Musk has a car that uses artificial intelligence. But what these leaders in the IT industry have said is we need rules about artificial intelligence. They don't want to ban it because it could do great things. I mean, imagine if when you go in for your health checkup and you get all the battery of tests that you get, if all of that information were fed into a diagnostician that was an artificial intelligence program, and it caught something that your doctor wouldn't catch. Today, X-rays and CT scans are being read by artificial intelligence, and they are capturing breast cancer that's escaping the doctors. They have a much higher accuracy rate of catching breast cancer on the tests. So there are good things that AI and machine learning can do, but what these people you're talking about, these leaders in the IT industry, are saying is we need to have limits. And one of the things they are calling for is a rule that if you're using artificial intelligence, we should be able to audit the decision-making so that we know how they came to the decision they came to, and see if there's any bias that's been built into the program, like with African Americans and mortgages in this one bank.
I'm John, and I was good at chemistry.
And you can't work at the State Department.
I had reason to start studying global warming about 10 years ago, and I've been studying it ever since, so maybe you guys will let me update you a little bit. The reason scientists talk...
As long as it's a question.
Oh, a question. I'll see if I can remember one while I'm talking.
Yeah. Pretend it's Jeopardy.
I
do it in the form of a question.
I definitely will end with a question. I'm just going there. I'm absolutely going there. I better start, though. The reason everyone talks about the water rising is because it's such a certainty. We know it with such a certainty. Almost with certainty, it's going to be 3 feet minimum, okay, till at 2100. Now, that will displace about 100 million people. Mm-hmm. Now, during the Syrian war, we displaced 5 million people. And what happened to the whole world? Okay.
That's a question. Okay.
That's my first question.
Now, one per customer. We got a lot of hands.
Oh, I'll go real quick. That is just the starting thing of things. Global warming is far worse than anyone in this audience understands. If they did, they would be calling their congressperson every week. Every conservative journal that is written, I got National Review for years. I switched to Weekly Standard, hoping they would give a little hint of honesty. Now, I'm coming to my question. They all lie, and they lie constantly.
It's got to be the next thing you say.
The question is, why? I think it's money. What do you think?
So I'm dumbfounded. I am really dumbfounded by senators and congressmen who deny that there is massive climate change happening. I can't understand it. Why don't they have grandchildren? No, seriously. Well, you know, the problem is that these things are going to happen. And even if we did a lot right now to address the sources of climate change, it's still the cat's out of the bag, and a lot of it's still going to happen. I say this in all honesty. Yeah, I'm a partisan Democrat, but I also just, as an American citizen, I don't understand how anyone can look at the data about sea level rise and climate change and not admit that it's happening. I mean, they won't even admit that it's happening. It's not a matter of debate about what should we do about it. They won't get that far. They just say it's not happening. Or yeah, maybe it's happening a little, but it's natural. These things happen every million years. Yeah, last time it happened, everybody died. You know, I do not understand their motivation. Some people say, oh, they're in the pockets, you know, of Exxon. None of those people, you know, the scientists at Exxon and the oil industry, they know what's going on, too. And many of the oil companies now are, you know, on board with doing something about it. I don't understand, except for one thing. For these politicians, when they deny climate change, there is a group of 28%, 35%, whatever it is in this country, that like to hear that. And they vote for them. That's why these politicians are doing it, because people vote for them when they say that. And then you ask, why do those people want that? You know, there's a real resentment, and we saw this in the Brexit vote in England. When the people of England were voting on whether or not to leave the EU, the TV in England was filled with experts, economic experts and others, saying why leaving the EU was a terribly stupid thing to do. And there was a reaction against experts. And after the vote, when they narrowly voted to leave the EU, when you went back and tried to analyze what was all the sources of the vote, one of the big factors was there's a group of people in England and the United Kingdom who just don't like experts and don't like, you know, people like me being a talking head on television. They just resent it. I think there's a voting bloc in this country that A, wishes climate change weren't true, and like an ostrich, if they stick their head in the sand, maybe it won't happen. But also, they just don't like experts, and they don't like being told that there's a problem and they have to change their way of life. So the politicians will continue to deny it as long as there are people who vote for them and allow them to get away with it.
Way up in the back.
How's the air up there?
Just fine. I'm very frustrated with what seems to be the rewriting of history, saying that we didn't have, or that we had a lack of intelligence on 9/11, and especially WMD. I have my copy of the 9/11 Commission report right here, and it had all kinds of warnings. And also about WMD, supplemental articles discounting yellow cake uranium, stockpiles of weapons, and ties to Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier about agenda inertia. And a theory I have is the Council on the American Century, Dick Cheney, Cohen, all the people that were involved in, you know, the planning of the Iraq war. Do you think that was an example of agenda inertia?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. What you had was a group of people who worked together before they came into the Bush administration, in the election campaign and getting ready to take over the government. A group of people around President Bush, not him, but Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, there's a whole slew of them, who had an agenda. And that agenda was that we should invade and occupy Iraq. We can talk for hours about why, but they had that agenda. And so when I came into the room and said, you're having all these meetings on Iraq, I need an urgent meeting on Al-Qaeda, they didn't want to hear it. They had their agenda. And dealing with Al-Qaeda was not part of it. So as to your point, was there were there intelligence warnings about 9/11? There were a ton. What I didn't know was how the attack would occur, where the attack would occur, or precisely when. I knew it would occur in the summer of 2001. I had enough intelligence reporting to indicate that. But we didn't know exactly where. And CIA was saying it would probably take place in the Middle East. I thought it could take place in the U.S., and that was why I was demanding an urgent meeting and didn't get it, because they were having their meetings on Iraq because of agenda inertia. So you're absolutely right.
Mr. Clark, thank you for coming. I had the pleasure of reading your cyber war book, and Jack, it did keep me up at night. Just would like a really quick update on, of course, we're all aware of what's happened with the election, but what's moved on since then? What are your solutions? Could you put your Cassandra hat back on?
So it's a little confusing because half of my books actually are fiction.
He's being generous about the percentage, I think.
Well, let's put it this way. Four of my books are novels, and four of them are nonfiction. And the book you're talking about, Cyber War, it was written 11 years ago, 10 years ago, and was a nonfiction book saying that militaries are moving into cyberspace and are going to be able to do things with cyber weapons that heretofore could only have been done with bombs or spies. The war was going to be taking place in cyberspace, but would have real effects in the real world. And I got a lot of criticism when the book came out from people who didn't believe it. No one laughs at it now. What we've seen is that over the course of that 10 years since the book came out, we've transitioned from hackers being, you know, the teenage boy who couldn't get a date on a Saturday night, because there was always a spike in hacking on Saturday nights. And I finally figured out why that was the case. We went from having hackers being individuals and sort of gangs of criminals in Romania or someplace hacking into banks in the U.S. To now, the major hacks that have occurred for the last 3 or 4 years are all done by military organizations. And the U.S. Justice Department has indicted, put out arrest warrants for named individuals in the Chinese People's Liberation Army for hacking into companies in the U.S., for the North Koreans by name, members of their military intelligence, for hacking into 144 universities in the United States. Bob Mueller, you've heard of him, has indicted a number of named Russian military intelligence officers for hacking into the United States. So we have hacking from Iran, their military, Russia, their military, China, their military, and North Korean military, into companies and institutions in the United States and around the world. So what's happened since the book is kind of what we predicted in the book, that cyber activities, hacking, have now become the provenance of military and military intelligence organizations. And they are doing things in the real world. This is not just moving ones and zeros around in cyberspace. They are stealing information, but they're also doing things like shutting off electric power grids. The Russians shut off the electricity in a large part of Ukraine through a cyber attack. The Iranians wiped out all of the software on the Saudi Arabian oil company, Aramco. I could go on, and I will. because book number 9 comes out in July. And book number 9 is called The Fifth Domain, and it's the sequel to Cyber War. The Fifth Domain, because in the Pentagon, they talk about domains. Land, sea, air, and space were the domains that the military operated in. And the Pentagon announced a couple of years ago that there's a fifth domain that they're going to fight in. And that fifth domain is cyberspace. So next July, get out of that great bookstore on the street down there and look for Fifth Domain.
And tonight, change your passwords. if I can get a microphone up here, Casey, and then in the meantime, there was a hand back here. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, on the expert front, so I think it was Irving Fisher, father of modern interest rate theory, super expert on the economy, a few weeks before the stock market crash in 1929, makes the prediction that we're about to enter into the longest run of economic growth ever in the history of the world, et cetera. And it seems like kind of maybe since the end of the Cold War, we lost our enemy, and that and many other dynamic factors, there's a lot of polarization. And I wonder how much experts kind of end up in camps that affect the point of view that experts put out and gets picked up by the media. In the case of Brexit, you know, the experts were largely in London, I think, talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And they managed to not get out to Liverpool, right, and find out that since the UK entered the European Union, real wages had not gone up. Mm-hmm. But the pay of the experts in London had gone up tremendously. So they resented that, I'm sure. But on the other hand, they weren't better off. So So the question is, do you think that polarization affects how experts' opinions get carried by the media, and maybe we don't get the real view of what they think?
Well, look, you can turn on Fox News tonight, and they have experts. And you can turn on MSNBC at the same time, and they have experts. And they're giving you completely different versions of the truth. So what we tried to say in the book is, how do we know when an expert is predicting something if they're trustworthy? And we have a checklist of questions to ask. One is, are they data-driven? And have they done peer review of their data? The really freaky thing in interviewing all of these people was the number of them from different fields who all said the same sentences to us. They said, I looked at the data, I saw we had an enormous problem, I hoped my data was wrong, or my analysis of the data was wrong, and so I took it to other experts and said, please show me where I'm wrong. And nobody could. We had five or six people say that exact phrase, those exact phrases to us. So the question is, are they an expert that was previously recognized by everybody as an expert before they made the prediction? Are they data-driven? Did they give the data over for peer review? Did anybody find anything wrong with their methodology? And then, who's paying for them to do the work? And do they stand to benefit in any way if we do the things that they are saying we should do? Well, clearly, you know, Jim Hansen does stand to benefit if the world doesn't, you know, melt. But he personally doesn't stand to benefit any more than any of the rest of us. There's no personal gain in it. And when we applied that test to all of our Cassandras, we found they all passed it. They were data-driven. They did peer review. They were not being paid by somebody who had an axe to grind. They didn't stand to personally benefit. They, you know, they hadn't bought up beachfront property in Kansas. So.
Richard, welcome to Traverse City from Michigan Writers. Most of us will not have access to the experts that you've talked about tonight, and we'll get our information from journalists. Could you talk about the role of journalists?
So I do a podcast called Future State. And we just wrapped up a season, but you can still go back and listen to them if you go to your Apple or wherever you get your podcasts, Future State. And one of the episodes we did was called Assault on the Media. And we talked about the value of investigative journalism and how investigative journalism prevents a lot of abuse. And we need to make sure that there's a place in our society for investigative journalism. Unfortunately, if you look at television in particular, where most people still get their news from, the people who own the TV networks now are not just the TV networks. They're big companies that do lots of other things. So I worked for ABC News for 15 years as a consultant. ABC News is part of Disney. And when ABC News wanted to do a story about child predators at Disneyland, that turned out to be a problem. NBC is owned by Comcast. Fox is owned by Rupert Murdoch and his empire. When corporate interests get in the way of investigative journalism, we have a problem. So I know it's old-fashioned to buy newspapers, but I subscribe to the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and I still get them in hard copy. I still get the papers to read. I could read them online. But I think it's important to support journalism. You know, the Washington Post was having trouble, and Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, or a lot of Amazon, Jeff Bezos bought it personally, not Amazon, but Jeff Bezos bought it and infused it with a lot of new money. They hired 40 new investigative reporters, and they changed. The only thing that Bezos wanted them to change. There's a little line on the banner on the Washington Post that he inserted, in small type on the front page, and it says, "Democracy dies in darkness." I think it's very important that even if you don't like a particular journalist, you don't like a particular news outlet, we need to defend our news outlets, our journalists, against the assault that they're currently under from the government. The kind of thing that's going on now with the President of the United States saying that the journalism are the enemy of the people, that's straight out of the Russian playbook. Actually, the phrase, the enemy of the people, is a phrase that Stalin came up with. We've got to be very careful that we don't slip into a different kind of country. Because when you slip into a different kind of country, it happens incrementally. And any one change doesn't seem like a big deal. And then you look back 5 years later, you're in a different kind of country. It reminds me of that experiment, you know, where you put the frog in the water, and you gradually turn up the heat, and the frog never thinks it's hot enough to jump out, because he's only detecting small change, and then the water gets so hot that the frog dies. Democracy can be like that.
We have time for just a couple more questions. There's hands waving in the balcony.
Hi, Richard. It's Tim from the People's Republic of Cambridge, a place you're familiar with, I think. Based on the systematic dismantling of the State Department, is it possible to restore it? And if that's too long-winded, maybe an anecdote about Colleen Raleigh, please.
The State Department suffered very badly under Secretary Rex Tillerson. He fired a lot of experts. He closed a lot of offices. There was an office in the State Department to worry about cybersecurity and cyber war. He closed it and fired the people. A lot of that kind of thing went on under Tillerson. And frankly, a lot of people who were past retirement age, I mean, they had been in the Foreign Service and the State Department long enough that they could have retired, they were still willing to work. They enjoyed what they were doing. They were national assets, national treasures. But because of the things that Tillerson did in the State Department, cutting it back and undercutting it, hundreds of them left. And you cannot go out and hire Robert Ford. You can't go find somebody who spent 30 years wandering in the Arab world and can speak six dialects. You can't go hire that again. You got to grow that again. And we, I think, lost a generation of experts out of the State Department. Now, the good news is the new Secretary of State, Secretary Pompeo, doesn't seem to think it's his job to destroy the State Department. He's trying, I think, to restore it. And, you know, gradually it can come back. But what we saw happen at the State Department is happening at EPA, it's happening at NOAA, it's happening at NASA, it's happening throughout the government, that experts are leaving the government and experts are being forced out of the government. And these are names that none of us will ever know. They're civil servants, they're foreign service officers, they're intelligence officers who could go out into the private sector and probably earn twice as much money as they can in the federal government. But they were filled with a sense of public service, and that's why they were staying there. And a lot of them have left. We're going to try somehow, I hope, in the next few years to get some of them to come back. But the other thing that's happening is that young people are not going into the federal service anymore. I used to teach at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and every year that kids would come up to me, kids, they were graduate students, and asking, how do I get in the government? That's not happening anymore. because of the image of working in Washington has changed. So we need to re-inspire young people as well as try to retain and maybe get back some of the older people to work in the federal service, because what the federal government does day to day that you don't hear about saves lives, makes us safe, makes us secure. All sorts of federal agencies that you wonder, you know, what the hell do they do? They all do something important. And the government's not the enemy. The government is filled with good people who are trying to do good things.
We have a last question in the audience, and this lady has been patiently. And so that'll be next to last. And then up here, yeah. And then we're done. Then we have to cut it off. But you have one up there, yeah? Go.
In the best of all possible worlds, how would you envision your Cassandra Committee being created? What kind of people would be in it? What would they... How would they work outside of not being in the White House?
You know, it doesn't have to be in the government. It could be a nice foundation, maybe Jeff Bezos. You know, it could be somebody who has a huge amount of money who just wants to create something like this. I envision 6 or 9 experts, scientists, engineers, policy people. A diverse background and a small staff, but they've got the money or the authority to hire experts to test propositions, so that if they discover someone coming in a field and saying there's a problem here, they're not going to themselves be the experts to figure that out. They're going to look to see if it fits the Cassandra formula. And if, all of those 24 indicators light up, if the Cassandra coefficient is high, that's what their job is. And then if it is, then they go out and they fund studies to verify that the Cassandra is right and to test the hypothesis and to test the data. And if they determine that the Cassandra is probably right, then they get the appropriate branch of the government to start planning to do something about it. So it's a very small organization of people who know about scientific principles and investigation and analysis, but they're not necessarily going to be the experts on the subject.
Last question.
Nate Peters, a proud member of the U.S. Forest Service. Thank you kindly, sir, for your service to this country and for being with us tonight. My question, and pardon me if I missed this in your remarks, but my question is, how can the Cassandras shape their messaging so that it both appeals to and inspires action by political leaders and the public alike? Thank you.
It's a very good question. You don't want to be like the original Cassandra who gets increasingly crazy. And is seen running around Troy, yelling at people. Frankly, some of the Cassandras in the book, there's one, a guy named Harry Makopoulos. Harry was an accountant in Boston. And he noticed that some of his clients were using Bernie Madoff to do their investments. And that on paper, they were making a lot of money. And so Harry started analyzing the Madoff fund and determined that it was a pyramid scheme. And he went to the SEC in Washington and reported it. They did nothing. He went back a year later. They did nothing. He went back a third year to report, and he had all the actuarial information. And they did nothing. And so he was starting to get a little crazy. And he thought, well, maybe Bernie Madoff is going to put a hit out on me. Maybe he's going to put a contract out on me. So this little accountant guy in Boston started wearing a gun. So it does happen. Jim Hansen, the expert on sea level rise, got so frustrated he chained himself to the White House fence. You remember that? That didn't help. So we do have a section in the book where we say, you know, if you are a Cassandra, here are some things you shouldn't do. Carry a gun. Chain yourself to the White House fence. No, but we do have a list of things that we suggest you do. And the key is to find champions. The guy, David Morrison, who got NASA to create the Planetary Defense Program and look for the asteroids, what he did was he found a couple of members of the Congress and a couple of members of the Senate and convinced them. I don't know how he was able to look at that entire body of 535 people and figure out the two or three people who could care about asteroids, but he did. So if you can find a champion and convince them, and that champion is credible and is a public official, or better yet, can do a documentary that can run on Netflix or something. There are ways of getting to people that are more convincing.
That was Richard Clark talking with Jack Siegel. Richard Clark's latest
please
book
join
is
me in thanking
warnings,
Richard Clark.
Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes. Support for the National Writers Series comes from Jonathan and Marissa Wege, supporting good things that need to happen now. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.